Business and Labor, and we'll have, we've got a couple bills sitting here, Senate Bill 160. We'll open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 160, and if you're also going to do 250, we'll get ready for that. We'll do 150 or 160 first. Dennis, would you like to just run through that quick, Mike?
Senate Bill 160 combines hearings on two issues, disqualification and overpayment of benefits. Amends ORS 657.310 and 657.315, authorizing notification of overpayment information to claimant at time of disqualifying decision. There's no revenue impact, and fiscal impact has been issued.
Okay, testimony.
Chair, did he say that it has a fiscal and hasn't been issued?
There's a fiscal impact statement issued. I've not received it, however. So I don't know what it says.
Okay, Tom. Any more questions, Senator?
Not yet.
Okay. Senator, let's have any more questions. Tom, introduce yourself for the record, please.
All right. Chair Nelson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Byerly. I'm the Assistant Director for Unemployment Insurance for the Employment Department. I'm here today to testify on Senate Bill 160. As the committee administrator indicated, we're rewriting two statutes that deal with unemployment insurance benefit overpayments. We see this as an issue of customer service, is why we've presented this. The change relates to the way we would notify claimant customers of an unemployment insurance benefit overpayment. Excuse me. As is typical in many states, sometimes individuals are found ineligible for unemployment insurance benefits for several different reasons. Possibly they mistakenly didn't give us the correct information. Sometimes they even willfully give us incorrect information, which creates an overpayment on their claim. The way we do business now is we would disqualify them from the receipt of benefits, allow them to go through an appeal process of that decision. Once that becomes final, then we turn around and issue a second decision that says, this decision on such and such a date found you ineligible for benefits, and now you owe us this much money. The problem with that lies in sometimes people don't understand the ramification of that decision, so they may not appeal it, and they don't get their full appeal rights. Then the subsequent decision comes along later and says, well, now you owe us some money, and they go, oh my gosh, this is a problem, I want to appeal it. But they missed the real chance to appeal the disqualification that created the overpayment. And so for customer service purposes, we want to combine the notices so they fully understand the ramifications, and then the appeal process would deal with it all up front. It would also provide us the ability to begin collections a little bit sooner than we do now, because we have two decision process. We would pen that first decision that found them ineligible for benefits for 30 days prior to issuing the overpayment decision, and then wait for that to become final, and about a week after the finality date of that, which usually is about 30 days, we would begin collection activity. We see this as being able to expedite the collection activity by about a month. What that results in is a fiscal impact of $60,000 in revenue. It's not new money, it just is collected sooner. I want to also stress that changing this is only affecting the information in the decision itself. It doesn't allow us to expedite the collection process per se. We still want to make sure that the decision that finds them ineligible is final before we start collection.
Question.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Byerly, I just want to be clear on when you want to begin the collection process. Do you want to begin the collection process before the appeal is finalized? Is that what you're saying?
Chair Nelson, Senator Walker, no, that's not the case. We want to make sure that it's completely final, that the decision is final, they've had their chance for appeal, and then that appeal period is exhausted as well. Okay. We never go after anybody's benefits until all their appeals have exhausted.
Okay.
Sure. Senator Byer.
Thanks. Do you have current figures of how much you are currently owed by overpayments?
Chair Chair Nelson, Senator Beyer, we have an accounts receivable for benefit overpayments of $27.2 million.
Excuse me, repeat that?
$27.2
million.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
You said this will not help you in your collection process. What do you plan on doing to help in your collection process to bring these collections up to date and collect this $27.2 million?
Chair Nelson, Senator Beyer, if I said that it wouldn't help our collection process, that I misstated. What I meant was it will expedite it so we can start collecting a little bit quicker than we are. With respect to the $27.2 million, we have been instituting several measures over the last few years, and in the 1997 legislative session approved several tools that we've been using, such as charging interest for benefit overpayments that we weren't able to do for years. And then we take that interest that is charged and accumulates into a fraud control fund that we use to staff revenue agents that do the collection, the payment to private collection agencies that do collections for us. It also goes to improving our computer cross-match system, where we cross-match employer reports that are submitted quarterly with our weekly claims. Just for the record, our receivables at the end of calendar year 2000 were $33.2 million. At the end of 2001, were $30.1 million. At the end of 2002, were $27.2 million. So we are doing our best to whittle away at that amount of money.
Mr. Chair, could I?
Yes.
How long do you hold a receivable in your agency before you turn it over to Department of Revenue to have them collect it?
Chair Nelson, Senator Beyer, I should know the answer to that. I believe it's a year, but I would appreciate if I could get back to you on that. Would that be okay?
Sure. And one more, Mr. Chair. Do you use any private collection agencies after Department of Revenue sends them back to you after they have them for a year, or?
Chair Nelson, Senator Beyer, we do use private collection agencies for that purpose, yes.
Thank you.
The shock of it was the $27 million in receivables and stuff.
Can I read those audit reports?
Yeah.
Shouldn't have been a shock.
what can you do? I mean, this bill obviously doesn't address any of those things. Anything you can do is from that viewpoint to speed up those collections or make those collections, or that's an ongoing figure. How does that all come about?
It's an ongoing figure, Chair Nelson. The overpayments are created from several ways. We have a cross match again that I indicated, where we look for people that are misrepresenting their earnings. We get tips and leads from outside sources. We have overpayments that result from individuals that may have inadvertently made a mistake in their reporting, and so we set up the overpayment. We have hearings decisions. Obviously, sometimes we can allow benefits at the first level. A hearing officer could then determine they're ineligible for benefits. That creates the overpayment. What we're trying to focus on is with the integrity of the program, is to prevent the overpayments from happening, and we're looking at ways now where we can get better information into the claimant's hands so as to prevent the overpayment, so we don't have to collect, which we see is a better way to go.
When you're combining the hearing dates, is that going to assist in this thing in any particular manner?
It will, because we see us being able to start collections approximately a month sooner. That way we can often reach people that may have moved or taken off and not pay their debt.
Okay, further questions from the commission?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Byerly, how does our $27.2 million compare with other states?
Chair Nelson, Senator Walker, I don't have that information with me. I could certainly get it for you.
I would like that, yes.
No problem. No problem.
We're being derelict in our duties. I'd also like our fellow Oregonians to know how many people are up there committing fraud on the department in some way. The second question I have is sort of a reverse of what you're talking about, because there was an email that I got regarding a situation of a constituent in my district who, if I can recall all of the details correctly, she was paid benefits when she wasn't supposed to, and it was not her error. It was your department's error, and now you're collecting interest from her on that. When it's the department's error, I don't think that an Oregonian who should be paying an interest for your error. So could you kind of tell me what the department's position is on that?
Chair Nelson, Senator Walker, you're exactly right. We shouldn't be charging interest for individuals that are overpaid benefits when it's our fault. In fact, under Oregon law, that is not the case. We have two statutes, ORS 657.310, which we can charge interest for, and ORS 657.315, which we don't charge interest for. Benefit overpayments created under 315 are those which we are not at fault, or excuse me, the claimant customer is not at fault. We don't charge interest for that. The particular constituent you're referring to had the federally funded temporary emergency unemployment compensation benefits where the federal government says we don't have a choice. We're looking at ways to get around that and use our own criteria here in Oregon to do the very thing that we think should be done, which is not charge interest. In fact, we're looking for a way to waive those type of overpayments.
Okay, so the department is working on that, and I appreciate that.
Absolutely. That was not handled very well.
No, it wasn't. All right, well, thank you. I appreciate the answer to my question.
Any further questions on 160? Any further testimony?
No, I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, when we're talking about this thing, Tom, is it, you know, we're going to get this on the floor of the Senate, people are going to say, you know, if they're aware of this, Senator Beyer is of the $27 million, they're going to say, you know, how does this thing help this bill out? And how does this bill help that situation out and to make sure that there isn't this fraud being committed and that type of thing? So, but from your viewpoint, it's combining the hearing dates, that's the key thing, and it's going to allow you to start your collection process more in a more sure manner?
More sure and more quickly, within 30 days.
And so that the claimants or the people involved at that time would know what the situation is.
Correct.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Yes. Senator Beyer.
I'm just, I was going to ask the question of if the department is, or have they issued a fiscal, two legislative fiscals that need to be forwarded to us. I see on the back it says an estimated fiscal of $60,000. Is that?
Chair Nelson, Senator Beyer, that was my testimony earlier. That was $60,000 in revenue. It's not new money. It's just collected 30 days sooner than it would have been otherwise.
Mr. Chair, I need a clarification. So a fiscal means it's going to cost you an extra $60,000. What you're telling me is that an increase of revenue of $60,000 or quicker of $60,000. Those are two different things.
Chair Nelson, Senator Beyer, I apologize. There is no fiscal impact as far as staffing or cost of the agency for this.
You collect the money quicker?
Collecting the money quicker.
Well, yeah, I'm just wanting to know if you're planning on sending this bill to the floor without a fiscal. There's, you know, I was wondering when I saw that this estimated fiscal of $60,000, but that with clarification, that didn't seem like a fiscal. That's a revenue. Mm-hmm. So,
okay. Any further questions? Close the work session on Senate Bill 160. Open up a work session. Senate Bill 160.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'd move that we send Senate Bill 160 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Walker is so moved that we send this bill to the floor for recommendation. Any comments from the committee?
You mark it.
If we get to the point where we have a if it's unanimous, the bill, we'll put it on our consent calendar. Would that be part of the motion also?
I just think there might be some questions.
Okay.
How do you feel about it? I think our colleagues deserve to know where the department is at collections.
Okay.
This actually addresses some of those issues. What do you think?
I think it's a good statement. The carrier may want to address that in their comments, but there may be questions too. So.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, sounds good. We will not do it on the consent calendar. So, just motion. Any objections?
Want me to vote no, so it can't go to the consent calendar?
No, because you're going to carry it.
Okay, the motion to move Senate Bill 160 to the floor with a due pass recommendation is
hereby approved.
Land Carrier.
Do you want to do it?
Want to carry it?
Not me.
All right, so okay. Senator Byer will carry it.
Carry this mobile thing.
All right. See, well, I thought it was going to be the same person testifying, but I see that it isn't, so we'll just go right down the order then. Senate Bill 199, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 199. And Dennis, would you like to give us a quick update on this?
Senate Bill 199 removes conflicts and statutes depriving persons the right of action against an endowment, cemetery's bond, or letter of credit. No revenue impact, no fiscal impact.
Well, very good. Witnesses Floyd and Dale, right? Please step up. Just going to let him do it, huh? Okay.
I'm here
for the record. All right. Floyd, just please introduce yourself for the record and commence your testimony.
Chairman Nelson, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Floyd Lanter. I'm the administrator of the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. We're a member of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm here today to request your support on Senate Bill 199. This bill clarifies existing law to assure that consumers do have a right of action against an endowment, cemetery's bond, or letter of credit. Now, as a way of background, prior to 2002, the Audits Division of the Secretary of State had responsibility for the regulation of this program. The 2001 legislature decided that it wanted an agency that was familiar with the regulation of financial institutions to oversee the program and transferred it to the department. The existing law contains an exception governing a person with a claim against the letter of credit or bond for certain providers of prepaid funeral services. And 199 does not change policy, but removes an apparent paradox in the statutory construction, which, if you followed it strictly as it's worded, would deprive individuals or persons of a right of action against the endowment, cemetery's bond, or letter of credit, which was intended to protect the consumers in the first place. It's fee neutral. I'm not aware of any opposition to it. And I respectfully request that you support the bill and send it to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Does this happen very often? Do you have these claims where people come in and the provider is not doing what they're supposed to be doing?
Chair Nelson, we've had the program for less than a year, or basically just a year now, and we have not had any complaints from consumers. This is a what I would call a housekeeping thing, a carryover from when we inherited the program. The bond form was reviewed by the Attorney General's office, and this was noted and passed on to us, so we're trying to get it corrected and cleaned up, so to speak.
So as part of your new duties, you're just looking through this and saying these things need to be cleared up. Questions from the committee? Senator Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know the history of this statute, how long we've had it?
Chair Nelson, Senator Byer, there are two portions to it, the pre-needs and the endowment care. The endowment, I don't know how far it goes back. I do know that the Secretary of State had responsibility for the endowment care since 1970. And for the pre-needs program, they had responsibility since 1985. And I don't know prior to that, sir.
Thanks. Any questions? Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lanter, you were in my office earlier this week because we're discussing a bill together, and I remember the name of the cemetery. It was Kern Family Services in Grants Pass and Medford, who created the law that was changed last, that changed the whole situation, the whole dynamic last session, and that's why this stuff is now in your lap, and you are administering it, so I appreciate that you're moving forward and doing these housekeeping matters to protect consumers against fraud in situations where they aren't able to sue a cemetery on these pre-need and endowment funds. So, thank you.
Chair Nelson, Senator Walker, thank you for the remarks. We do plan to review the legislation with stakeholders after we've had a period of a year under our belt, so to speak, to iron out a few more things.
Okay, very good. Further questions? Further witnesses. David, you don't want to come and testify. Or Dan. It's Dave or Dan? Dale. Dale, okay. You don't want to testify. Very good. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 199. Open up a work session on Senate Bill 199. And the chair would move this bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation of the consent calendar. Senator Buck.
Thank you. Question of Mr. Dotson, the administrator. Dennis, under your background, you have conflicts in ORS 97.99 and ORS 97.929.
Obviously, yeah. I'll have to correct that, Senator. I apologize.
Are you reading them?
Everybody's great on detail.
I just want to know what the conflicts in the same statute were.
That's my question. All right. Any further comments, discussions, motions on in front of the committee to move this to the floor of the Senate with due pass recommendation under the consent calendar? Any objection? So ordered. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 200.
Carry your turn.
Oh, Carrie, I'll carry that. I'm the expert in cemeteries.
Hope that doesn't mean you're close to being in one.
My first session, I carried the first cemetery that I remember. They took the rookie. It was a cemetery bill.
Ah.
So I claim those as my own these days.
Mine was Ira's.
That same session, my Representative Montgomery was on the committee and I was chairing, and he was our designated cemetery guy.
Cemetery, that's right. This guy's from Eastern Oregon. We identify. Red River is in Eastern Oregon, isn't it? according to Bob Montgomery, it certainly is.
He used to say you had to pack a lunch to have dinner somewhere in his district.
That's good. Dennis, do you want to go ahead with 200?
Senate Bill 200, and this may answer Senator Byers' earlier question of other statute, removes contradictory language and reconciles provisions of ORS 97929 with ORS 97937. Requires master trustees to submit annual reports and pay for audits conducted by director under 97847 subsection 2. It includes master trust and statute and authorizes directors to suspend or revoke certificate when provider or trustee become insolvent. Removes requirement that director refer violations to law enforcement and authorizes discretionary judgment. Authorizes fees on prearranged sales to be remitted annually rather than semi-annually and increases criminal sanctions from Class C to Class A misdemeanor. No revenue impact, no fiscal impact.
Okay.
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, this is another housekeeping bill, as I would characterize it, to remove inconsistencies and clarify the provisions and intent of existing law. To that end, it deals primarily with master trustees and particularly with rules that were established after we inherited the program. And so what it'll do, it'll require annual reports from master trustees as well as providers of pre-need plans, require master trustees to pay the cost of exams. Extends the law to cover providers and trustees doing business without having secured the requisite certification or registration required by the statute. It permits the director to suspend or revoke certificates and registration of insolvent providers and trustees. And it makes the director's referral to local and federal law enforcement authorities discretionary rather than mandatory. And lastly, it creates some criminal sanctions for providers and master trustees who misuse trust funds. Again, the bill is fee neutral, and we're not aware of any opposition to it.
But will it be fee neutral if you change the violation from a Class C to a Class A misdemeanor? What's the effect of that?
The Chair Nelson, the effect is we're trying to move it from a Class C to a Class A misdemeanor. The impact would be, under Class C, it's 30 days in jail and a $1,000 fine. Class A would be 1 year in jail and up to $5,000 in fines.
It might be a cost there, you know, if you're in jail. A few more. I mean, has anybody ever been charged under one of these statutes, or you are? Has that a class? Has a Class C misdemeanor?
I'm not aware of it, Chair Nelson. As Senator Walker alluded to, one of the reasons that we inherited this program was a huge multi-million dollar fraud in the industry in the Medford area, Kern Funeral Home. But I don't know if that individual was charged or not.
Oh, I can answer that. Because I was at that individual's sentencing hearing, and he went to jail. And I was very pleased that he went to jail.
It was something bigger than this. I mean, it was
absconding with pre-need trust funds. He spent them on pleasure boats, art, vacations, whatnot. The folks were all made whole because Daddy wrote a check to pay for it, but I didn't think that was appropriate, that he shouldn't serve jail time anyway, and neither did the judge, so he went to jail and served as an example and helped change the whole industry and how it was computed. So he was charged with pretty significant crimes.
It was probably felonies, and this is a misdemeanor. Also, definition of a master trustee, I guess I haven't heard that. Can you add something to...
Chair Nelson, let me give you a little background on that. When we inherited the program, that term came into being, if you will. We thought that there would be more consumer confidence in the system if there were master trustees. And by definition, those are institutions or entities that hold trust funds, these funeral trust funds, for providers. And think about it like an escrow agent, somebody holding funds until a certain action is completed.
Is it usually the funeral director himself, or who is the trustee?
Chair Nelson, the master trustee cannot be a provider. Okay. It has to be an independent party.
Okay. Who would that, I mean?
Chair Nelson, there are two that service the industry right now.
That's a nationwide thing, or is it?
Well, one of them covers the western United States. The name of that is American Funeral and Cemetery Trust Services. I don't have a lot of detail on that because we, as the program is new, we haven't received any annual reports from these folks yet. The other is a DBA of the Oregon Funeral Directors Association, and that's called National Funeral Trust Services. There are 52 Oregon-based participants in that master trustee, and it currently has $94 million in trust funds that it's administering or handling.
Okay, any further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your testimony said it requires annual reports from master trustees and requires master trustees to pay the cost of the exam. Is that new or is that already existing?
Chair Nelson, Senator Beyer, no, it is not new. It's existing in the administrative rules. I mentioned earlier when we inherited the program, we had to develop administrative rules, and we're trying to incorporate some of those rules into the statute now that we've had a chance to work with them a little bit.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So what are the fees now, and what would they become under this legislation?
Chair Nelson, Senator Beyer, the rules allow us to charge $60 an hour for examination work.
And is that not changing then with this legislation?
Chair Nelson, Senator Beyer, no.
Okay, then one more, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Did I hear you say that you are doing this now, and you think the statutes need to reflect what you're doing?
Chair Nelson, Senator Beyer, We have not started examinations of master trustees, even though the statutes allow an audit or the rules allow an exam. Since there are only two, and when they became registered with the department, we received financial information and background information. But we have not examined any of those yet, any of the master trustees. We plan to start this year or later.
Would that be providing this bill passes?
Pardon?
Would that be providing this bill passes?
Chair Nelson, Senator Beyer, yes.
Thank you. Okay. Further questions? Well, how is this now? How is this helping consumers again? Did you?
Chair Nelson, well, in terms of helping consumers, first of all, we have the legislation in place that protects consumers from primarily misuse or fraudulent activities in terms of this. The industry is built on the pretense where you pay in advance for your pre-need funeral plans, if you will. A recent study I read showed that about 30% of the population over 50 actually has these in place. And so that's a lot of money that comes into control of a provider or a master trustee when, in fact, the service is not delivered until the consumer dies or decides to revoke their agreement. So the statutes are designed to make sure that the funds are handled appropriately and invested appropriately, and the examination function that we have available to us will be designed to ensure that the statutes are being followed.
Okay. Further questions? Further questions? This issue on changing from a Class C to a Class A, I mean, potentially that is... It would be a fiscal impact, and I don't did that. They say anything?
No fiscal. This came out of the legislative fiscal. I have no expenditure, no fiscal. It's no expenditure impact on state and local governments. Well, it just seems to me it would have an impact if you spend an extra 100 or 200 or 300 days in jail rather than you'd learn. But. So I guess we'll take it at that.
It doesn't happen very often, so.
Yeah, it doesn't happen.
Let's hope not.
That's good. Okay. Any other further testimony? If we close the public hearing on Senate Bill 200 and up a work session on Senate Bill 200. Any comments from the committee? Any concerns?
No.
Well, chair would move that Senate Bill 200 to the floor. And if they do pass recommendation under the consent calendar, if it's an unanimous vote. Any other questions, comments, objections? So ordered. Senator Bell, 200. Vicki, Senator Walker, would you like to carry this one?
Sure. I thought you were the designated cemetery guy.
Well, you seem to know a lot about this yourself.
I do. I'd be happy to.
Okay, very good.
This case also went to bankruptcy court that I was discussing.
Sure, you know, huh?
And so I know quite a bit about what happened in that
case.
But I'd be happy to, Mr. Chair.
All right. Spread the load around. Okay. Senate Bill 234, we'll open a public hearing on. Mr. Dotson, would you care to discuss a little bit of 234?
Senate Bill 234 repeals requirement that Workers' Compensation Management Labor Advisory Committee review all temporary rules adopted by the director. No revenue impact, no fiscal impact.
Okay. Witnesses, John. Coming up. Welcome, John, and please introduce yourself and start your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Nelson, and members of the Business and Labor Committee. I'm John Schultz. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is a part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm here today to request your support of Senate Bill 234, which we think eliminates an unnecessary administrative process that's currently mandated by the statute. As some background, the Workers' Compensation Division establishes disability rating standards for rating injured worker impairment. About 60 times a year, the division is required to establish rating values where the worker's disability is not covered by our permanent disability rating standards. An example of this would be some sort of unique disability, cold intolerance, for example, where we would not currently have that in our rating standards. The temporary rules that we develop determine the amount of permanent disability benefits that are due to a worker as a result of their impairment. The current law requires the Workers' Compensation Management Labor Advisory Committee to review these temporary rules in their subsequent meetings after the rules are adopted by the department. The development of those temporary rules or rating standards for specific or unique conditions is very technical in nature. The mandatory review by the Management Labor Advisory Committee hasn't resulted in added benefit to the system, although it does create extra tasks for the Management Labor Advisory Committee as well as the Workers' Compensation Division. Senate Bill 234 simply removes this administrative mandate, which is in the statute. And I'd be happy to try to answer any questions about the bill.
Senator Meyer, you're our resident expert on workers' comp.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Good to see you again, John. First question you have to ask is, MLAC improve this bill?
Chair Nelson, Senator Meyer, it's good to see you again, too. We have presented the bill in concept to the Management Labor Advisory Committee, and they are in favor of it.
Okay, Eddie, you say anything on the Senate?
No, it makes sense. It clearly says that the statute doesn't require them to approve it, just review them, and if it's not serving any function, why do it?
Yeah. Okay, any further questions? We'll public hearing on Senate Bill 234, work session on Senate Bill 234, and the chair would entertain a motion to send Senate Bill 234 to the floor with a due pass recommendation under consent calendar if there is a unanimous vote.
So moved.
Any discussion, any disagreement? If not, some order to Senate Bill 234 to the floor with due pass recommendation. And Carrier, do you want to carry that? Senator Barr will carry that.
Resident workers' comp.
The resident workers' comp expert. He is, too. Open up public hearing. Senate Bill 250. Mr. Batson, sir.
Senate Bill 250 authorizes state agencies to utilize performance reporting and information systems to measure workforce performance. No revenue impact, no fiscal impact.
Okay, we have one witness, Graham. Welcome, and please introduce yourself when you get ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Graham Slater, the Research and Workforce Economic Information Administrator for the Employment Department. You've been given written testimony here, and I just want to highlight some of the key facts for you. Senate Bill 250 is essentially the next step in a 10-year process, more than 10 years, of developing a system that will tell us whether individuals who are served by the workforce system, training, education, job placement kinds of entities, do they actually find jobs at the end, what are their wages like, those kinds of things. Way back in the late 80s, we started developing these kinds of ideas that we'd be able to tell if these efforts were successful. Senate Bill 81 in 1993 started the shared information system, which, as you'll see in a few minutes, we're proposing to start sunsetting. After the Workforce Investment Act was passed at the national level in 1998, pretty much all the players in that workforce system, community colleges, Department of Human Services, Employment Department, vocational rehabilitation and so on, they agreed that under this new bill, the shared information system was no longer going to be sufficient. And so we started the process of developing something new, bigger, better to meet the information needs. Senate Bill 400 from the last session, you can see in front of you, allowed us to establish this system to collect and analyze and share the information that was needed. And that's the system that now has become known as the Performance Reporting Information System, or PRISM for short. I'll just use PRISM from now on. It's administered by the Employment Department, partly because we are the designated employment statistics entity under the Workforce Investment Act. And my responsibility in the economic analysis, kind of number crunching area, makes us the logical people to do this stuff. So during late 2001, after the last session and parts of last year, all these agencies, the Workforce Investment Board, various subcommittees, policy groups came together, defined the data elements, talked about the computer systems, working together as a partnership. And as of late last year, we do have actual reports out on the web that give the kind of information that we're talking about. So PRISM, since the last session, is up and active and alive and working. And again, therefore, we feel the time is right to start now winding down SIS and moving things into PRISM. So this bill would do two things. Start the process of shutting down a shared information system. And the reason that we say start the process is that, as you'll see in a second, some of the measures take a year and a half to go through the system. If we're trying to measure whether someone's wage has increased over 15 months, we don't want to just shut it down on a certain day because there's still useful information to be gleaned from it. But under this bill, nobody would be sending new information to SIS after the end of this year. Everything would be transitioning to PRISM. And that's the second thing. It gives an official name to this new system, Performance Reporting Information System. And then thirdly, it allows greater flexibility. What we found as this has been developed is that there's all kinds of, mostly public sector, but it could be private sector too, education, workforce training entities that see what we're doing, and they have the desire to say, so do our customers, do our students, do our clients find jobs when they're done here? Do they stay employed after they're done here? And we want the ability to work out agreements with them so that we can give them that information too. We feel like it makes as much sense for them as it does for someone that happens to be part of the original group that put this forward. Okay, moving to page two, I just want to give you a couple of examples of the kinds of information that we'll be able to get from this. And these are real numbers from the most recent data available. And again, they're also the first numbers, so this is fairly late-breaking information. For example, 75% of the individuals that were served by the workforce system, again, that's the one-stop system under the Workforce Investment Board, did find employment after they'd received the services. That could have been some short-term training, it could have been more in-depth, it could have been a variety of things, but 75% of them found employment. Of those who found employment, 58% stayed employed for four consecutive calendar quarters. So the intent of that one is to measure retention in the workforce. And then thirdly, the other goal that was set by the Workforce Board was to measure the increase in wages over a period of time. And so of those individuals that were employed immediately and also employed a year later, their average wages have gone up by 82 cents an hour. Now at this point, we don't have a lot of context for that. I mean, they're just numbers, and the obvious thing is 75% good, or is it bad, or it's on. This is so new that we really just have these first basic numbers. The 75% is pretty consistent with what we were finding from the shared information system in the years that we were using it, particularly. But over the next few years now, as this program is completely developed, as you can see in the next paragraph, we're pleased that we'll be able to develop baseline performance measures. We may be able to come back and say, well, 75 was good in the recession, but as we came into recovery, that went up to 79 or whatever percent. We'll also be able to assess the trends over time. And maybe most interestingly, we'll be able to contrast the performance based on gender and based on education levels, based on geographic regions in the state. And a lot of that information is already out on our website just for this one time period. But again, the richness will be when we can do this over an extended time period. We believe that this bill represents some pretty good things in government, and I know they're not always heard about, but We think it's flexible and it's adaptive. The new statute, it's what our customers want. It's what the workforce board wants. It's a great example of collaboration between entities, both at the director level down to the computer level and dealing with the confidentiality issues of sharing information. It's definitely a good example of avoiding duplication. Every one of these entities could be trying to invent their own system. Instead, we're doing one that serves us all. And also, as I say, we're proposing to basically get rid of the shared information system over time rather than having two systems that pretty much do the same thing. We don't want to do that. And finally, something I think came up earlier, because this PRISM is in statute, we're coming to you pretty much every session right now to say, here's where it's going, here's the changes that we need, so that we don't end up coming back in 10 years and saying, well, here's what it used to say, but it's gradually evolved, and now we're coming to talk to you about it. So we're trying to do it hand in hand. Final three considerations for you. The concepts of the bill have been shared with all the partner agencies, everybody who could be affected. All the participants in CIF and PRISM are aware of this. They're all supportive of it. We know of no opposition to it at all. In preparing today's testimony, we did come across 9 words that change an important point to us from the original concept that we submitted to the final wording that's on your bill. So we've talked to the administrator, and we plan on asking for an amendment, probably at your earliest convenience, just to delete 9 words, which we didn't intend to be there in the first place. And it has to do with us being able to share membership in this system with all those workforce entities that ask for it, that issue I addressed earlier. The bill will have no fiscal impact. It's always been our intent, since we first proposed this, to gradually shift people from CIS to PRISM. So this is business as usual for the partner agencies and for us. If we were to keep CIS going, then it would have a fiscal impact because we'd be running duplicate systems. But by making this transition, we'll be in good shape. And then finally, I just do want to say it has no negative impact on any of the pretty strict requirements in terms of confidentiality and the sharing of information. You know, we are dealing with individual people who receive government services, and obviously the sharing of that and the tracking of did they find jobs, did they stay employed, is very confidential. But nothing in today's bill changes any of those things which have been set up over a decade with the Attorney General's office and so on. So that's the end of my testimony. I'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you. I'm just looking at this. This is a program that's been in place for what, about 10 years?
The shared information system has, yes.
And I know it's the purpose it says down there at the bottom of the page. You want to develop policy about policy and plan to measure performance. And that's not being changed, but I'm just kind of wondering, is this what's the practical effect? Is this really doing any good for anybody, or how is this really helping anybody?
Thank you, Chair Nelson. The shared information system does produce a report to the legislature, which we've done every year since 93, and in fact I do have copies with me if any of you are interested. It will be coming to all of you anyway. The information also goes to the agency heads, and that's where there's a lot of interest, and that's where we see the value. In theory, you know, each of them can look at their programs and say, let's say the average was 75%, you know, if their agency was only at 55% for the people finding jobs, one would assume that they'd want to look and say, well, why is that? Now, part of it is that they all serve different customers. Some of them may have much bigger barriers to getting employed than others, but if their trend over the last few years is slipping or improving, or if the wages that their customers or clients are getting, that's all information that's available to them to make decisions on that simply didn't exist 10 years ago. One of the keys with PRISM compared with CIS is that that information is totally public. It's all on our website now. Under CIS, we just gave it back to the individual entities, and it was up to them to choose to share it publicly or not. And that was one of the deliberate decisions 2 years ago, was to say this is a completely open system where anybody can just log on and get the numbers. And I do have some printouts of the most recent numbers and the CIS report if any of you would like it. But
I'm just trying to figure out, is there value to the entire program?
Okay.
That's really what I'm at.
Mr. Chair, my answer would be without it and before it, we really had no clue whether the people that were served in the workforce system found jobs, increased their wages, or did any other real benefits. So the absence of it means no information. The presence of it means people can make good decisions, yes. I believe.
Okay, further questions? Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions. Number one, what are your 9 words you want to change?
Okay. It's in... It's in the section 2 where it talks about 657.734. Let's see, I'll give you a line number.
18, is it line 18?
Yes, exactly. And it's actually right on line 18 that the nine words that we would like to delete are at the end of that line, have applied to be one-stop system partners. The intent of that section was to say if they wanted to be a member of PRISM and the director approved it, they would be welcome. Somehow in the translation it became if they wanted to be a member of the one-stop system, and that was not the intent. The one-stop system is addressed in section A right above that. So,
you'd like that to leave it out, really?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any further questions at Senator Barr?
Yeah, I see under section, I guess it's section 2, be the new dash 7, page 4, lines 32 through 35, the department may charge a reasonable fee for disclosure of the reports. Who is the, I mean, to public bodies or private agencies, do you charge a fee? How much is it? Who determines whether or not it's reasonable?
Okay. Now, Mr. Chair, Senator Baya, there's two parts where we charge a fee. One is to the partner agencies, and that's just part of the partnership of them being in it. The fee that would have to do with publishing reports, to my knowledge, we never have charged for that. It's on the website. It's very publicly available. We do, though, occasionally, for any of our research work, we do charge a fee if a particular customer wants really detailed, time-consuming kind of research. Then we simply charge enough to cover the staff cost of doing it, and an hourly amount for the research analyst time. That's been considered reasonable over about 20 years, and to my knowledge, we've never had any resistance to that, if you will. So,
Mr. What do you charge? What's the fee you charge to the agencies that are reporting into it? Because there are many.
Mr. Chair and Senator Baya, the fee that they paid last time, which was for development and maintenance of both systems, of course, was $87,200. And then in order to make some improvements to PRISM, which will be done by the end of this biennium, by June, they paid an additional $25,000 apiece. That was four partner agencies. We funded, I think it was $164,000 just in addition ourselves to help this thing get developed. For the next biennium, we're looking at roughly those same numbers. It's difficult to give you an exact number because the amount of membership in the system will in part determine how much the partners pay. So if it would remain just four key partners, it would be those amounts. If others join, then the amount goes down because we're sharing the cost between a bigger group.
Mr. Chair, in a sense, I don't know what the funds of the Employment Department are. There are $164,000, but $132,000 paid by the Department of Education, the University System, the Community College Workforces Development Departments. Those are general fund dollars you're talking about. And so I guess, you know, half a million dollars, general fund dollars. Are we getting the use out of that money that these agencies are paying? How does this compare to what the Progress Board, for instance, is doing? Supposed to be tracking, you know, a lot of this information. Is this a duplication of effort?
Yeah, I think those are good questions. Do you have a response to that?
Chair Nelson and Senator Beyer, I'll just address the Progress Board. It does not in any way duplicate what they're doing. That's my belief. My area also provides them with a lot of the employment-related workforce information for there are five key benchmarks that we provide information for. You know, this one is really trying to say, does your program help people find jobs? As opposed to the benchmarks, which are much broader, is Oregon itself growing or becoming more diverse and those kind of things. This one is saying, you know, agency director here, local one-stop partner there, is your program helping people find jobs when you're all done serving them? So it's kind of a different level of information. I don't believe it duplicates. The question of the use of general fund, that's a different one, and maybe those agency heads could also address the value to them.
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, I'm going to pick out Department of Education, whose mission is educating children, and obviously they run a couple of special schools. And we hear, personally, I get criticized all the time for, you know, we put in a ton of money on the top of the K-12 system, and not much of it's getting into the classrooms. And here's another example of $132,000 the Department of Education is spending on what I would call non-education items. And I guess I have a hard time justifying the use of
general fund education dollars to get these annual reports. I failed, it's not clear to me what good information the Department of Education can get out of employment reports.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bayh, it's just been mentioned to me, and I think this is relevant, that number one, for the programs that are part of this, they are required under the WIA to do some kinds of performance measurement. So that's one factor in this. And as I'm listening to your comments on general fund, it's coming through my mind that at least for education, and I believe for community colleges also, I don't think it is general fund dollars, because I think these programs are under the Carl Perkins vocational professional technical education, and I think those are probably federal dollars too. Now, I'm not the expert on their funding sources, but as you were talking, and I'm thinking K-12 general fund, that's not the people that we're measuring here. It's the professional technical training kinds of activities, both community colleges and K-12. I don't think that's general fund, but we could certainly find out for you. We can check with those agencies.
I don't think we should before we move in, because we have an amendment against the
review. Yeah, I appreciate it.
I was thinking the same thing, since we have an amendment that needs drafted in the meantime.
We'll check for you.
You might get that information.
We will. No problem.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
It's my understanding that the Progress Board is no more because we cut the heck out of their budget.
So, would you like to an update on that?
Yeah.
In January, eBoard, the Progress Board, was reinstated.
Thank you for that information.
All right.
I voted no, by the way, on eBoard.
Okay.
Okay, any further questions, discussion in this public hearing? Any further witnesses? I don't see any of your post-public hearing. We will not go into work session. We'll work on the amendments, and there's some information that we need to get hold of and satisfy the members of the committee. So we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill, what is this, 234, is it? No, 250. All right. Very good. And we'll get some of that information and start working on that. Any other comments or discussions from the committee? I can let you know I was talking to some folks this morning that are going to be some PUC bills coming in that I think may be fairly controversial. There's some pretty significant changes.
Were they
PUC? PUC bill. I'll try and get you some information on what that's going to be about. But, we're requesting that those come to this committee, so we'll work on that to give us information to you as we can. Anything else? Any other discussions? Any other comments? We will declare the public hearing.
Today's Wednesday.
Wednesday. We will not be meeting Friday. We'll be meeting next Monday.
Okay.
Okay. No other comments. So we declare the public meeting closed.